for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The U.S. Senate is considering a trade bill similar to one passed by the House last week. It's aimed at addressing currency manipulation by China and other countries, which many believe harms U.S. competitiveness. Joining me in the studio to talk about currency reform and trade policy, see Fred Bergsten of the Peterson Institute for International Economics and Kenneth Lieberthal at the Brookings Institution. Joining us by phone from New York, former Ambassador Thomas Niles of the U.S. Council for International Business. We do welcome your calls throughout the program. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org, as you can tell. I am still recovering from my latest voice treatment. I assure you, it is not throat cancer, as some have asked. It is spasmodic dysphonia. I was treated 2 weeks ago. It will get better. Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
Fred Bergsten, let me start with you. Explain the bill that the House passed and what it would do.
The issue is Chinese manipulation of their exchange rate against the dollar. The Chinese intervene massively in the currency markets to the tune of about $1 billion every day for the last 5 years. They buy dollars to keep the price of the dollar high, keep the price of their currency low. That, of course, then improves their competitiveness in international trade. It acts like a huge subsidy for all their exports at a high tariff on all their imports. So it's a huge distortion of trade. It's a massive protectionist measure. Estimates vary on how big that effect is. My own estimates, based on a lot of in-depth research, is that it's at least 20%. Some say as much as 40%, but it's high. And it clearly does inflate very greatly China's massive trade surplus, and it helps our trade deficits stay very high, which, among other things, takes jobs away from the United States. What this bill would do is authorize the U.S. government to treat that currency manipulation as an export subsidy for purposes of applying countervailing duties. Countervailing duties are tariffs that, under international rules, countries can apply when other countries unfairly subsidize their exports and thereby steal market share. Currency undervaluation has not heretofore been regarded as an export subsidy for purposes of applying these duties. The new bill would authorize doing so. But the key word is authorize. The bill itself would not apply any tariffs. If the bill were to pass, and there are many steps left in the process, then individual industries would come into the U.S. government, petition for duties to protect their industry on the grounds that the currency undervaluation was a subsidy and that their industries were being injured as a result. The U.S. government would then go through an elaborate process, figure out if that was right. If it passed muster, if the petition passed muster, the countervailing duties would go on. But that's not the end of the process.
Right.
Because then the Chinese, if they were the target, could conclude that the U.S. had itself not acted fairly under the international rules and could take the United States to the World Trade Organization in order to get redress and insist that the U.S. undo the duties. Then it would go through a WTO process, and the whole thing would spin out over quite a period of time.
Yeah, it sounds as though it would take years to carry that through.
If the Chinese did protest U.S. action under such a law, the whole process could easily take 2 or 3 years. In the meanwhile, the countervailing duties would be in place because the U.S. would have put them on. There would be a deterrent to trade. The underlying objective of this, of course, is not to apply new duties and restrict trade. It's to help persuade the Chinese to let their exchange rate go up substantially. That's the objective of the exercise, and that's really the $64 trillion question.
Sending a message to the Chinese. Ken Lieberthal, would it do so?
I think the Chinese recognize that this would be taking a pop gun to kill an elephant. As Fred explained, this does not apply countervailing duties across the board. Cases have to be brought one at a time. Each generates a lot of government analysis and review that's required. And a case can be brought only if you can allege that the Chinese actions are causing harm to an industry currently in the United States. But, of course, a lot of Chinese exports to the United States are not competing with goods produced domestically here, so we have no way to get at those. So this is really small scale. I think the Chinese would take this as a problem, but they see it more as a political problem than an economic problem, see it as a measure of the level of political concern about our trade balance. I think, frankly, this is a rather poor way at getting at that issue, and it would not do much on its own. But the Chinese certainly would be very unhappy to see it become law.
Tom Niles, would, in fact, this bill help American business and industry?
Well, no, I don't think it would help at all. First, let me say I don't think there's any question that the Chinese are manipulating their currency for trade advantage. Even the Chinese recognize in their own statements that they're doing this, and surely, I agree with Mr. Bergson that the renminbi is heavily undervalued, perhaps 20, 25, 30%. And it is having a major distorting impact on international trade. But the thing we do not want to do, I believe, is to turn what is essentially a problem of China versus the rest of the world into a U.S.-China bilateral issue, which I think this legislation would do. It also, and I agree with Mr. Lieberthal, it would not significantly help U.S. business. It would divert some Chinese exports now coming to the United States to other low-cost countries like Mexico, Vietnam, Indonesia, et cetera. But, and we might conceivably have a lower trade deficit as a result, but it would not have a major impact on production or employment in the United States. What we need to do now, and this is happening, by the way, is to find ways to multilateralize the pressure on China to do the right thing, which ultimately is in the interest of China. I might just note that just today in Brussels, the Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao met with the European Union leaders and was told that China should allow, and I quote, an orderly, significant, and broad-based appreciation, unquote, of the renminbi. And I see on the front page of this morning's Financial Times that the Institute of International Finance, which is an organization grouping about 400 major banks around the world, has essentially called for the same thing. So the Chinese have the message. There's no question about that. Prime Minister Wen Jiabao got it from President Obama last week in New York. At the UN, and I think this will be the center of the IMF-IBRD annual meetings, which take place in Washington at the end of this week. So we need to be a little patient and not turn a multilateral issue into a bilateral U.S.-China trade spat.
So, Fred Bergston, is China getting the message?
If so, they're getting it painfully slowly. I fully agree with Ambassador Niles. This is a global concern about China's manipulation. It should be handled through multilateral channels. The discouraging note is that there have been efforts of that type for at least 5 years in the International Monetary Fund, in the G20, throughout its 2 years of summits. The whole rebalancing concept is aimed at China reducing its big trade surpluses, the U.S. no longer relying on debt-led debt finance consumer-led growth, but rather having more investment and a stronger trade balance. The Chinese have said all the right things about participating in that project and adjusting their policies accordingly, but it's been painfully slow to implement anything. The exchange rate is not by any means the whole of this strategy, but it's a central and essential part, and they have not let the currency go up more than a minuscule amount. And that's what's really led patience to go so short. I testified to both Senate Banking Committee, House Ways and Means Committee on this 3 weeks ago, which triggered now this congressional action we're talking about. And the level of patience and tolerance has literally, I think, come pretty close to running out.
But Fred, what about Ambassador Niles' comment that what we might be doing is making this a bilateral confrontation as opposed to seeing it from the broader world perspective?
I think that's absolutely correct. And I think the administration will use the initial congressional steps to try to rally that multilateral coalition to deal with China. The Europeans, the other emerging markets, certainly do not want the U.S. to start applying new trade barriers because, after all, the countervailing duties could apply to them as well as China. So hopefully this legislative effort would mobilize the international coalition, to which I think the Chinese would listen more clearly.
Fred Bergstedt, he's director of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Do join us, 800-433-8850. And we're talking about China's currency, how it's fluctuated, and how the U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bill that would begin the process of imposing some kind of penalty on China for continuing to manipulate its currency. It would be a very long process. Here in this studio, Fred Bergstedt. He's author of China's Rise and director of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Ken Lieberthal is with the Brookings Institution and on the line with us, Ambassador Thomas Niles. He is vice chair of the U.S. Council for International Business. Just before the break, Ken Lieberthal, I know you want to comment on Fred Bergstedt's statement.
Yes, the issue was to what extent the U.S. should push to make the pressure on China multilateral rather than make us the point of the spear on this issue. And I just want to comment that many Chinese see the U.S. now as engaged in a wide-ranging effort to stop China's rise, because we're the preeminent power in the world. We, in their view, cannot tolerate another power rising to a roughly co-equal status. And so they attribute evil motives around this kind of logic to a lot that the U.S. does. That simply reinforces the virtue of our making this a multilateral effort and not being the point of the spear on it. Because when India, Indonesia, Brazil, and others join in the pressure on China, then this makes it a more legitimate issue on the Chinese side.
How likely is China to respond?
I think the Chinese will respond, but I think they'll respond gradually. Our image of the Chinese economy, the popular image, is it's just booming along and these guys are in a tremendously enviable position. Their image of their economy is they've got problems everywhere. They face a lot of social instability. They're very worried about unemployment. And with a succession coming up in China, everyone is afraid to rock the boat. So you get a lot of cautious reaction there rather than bold reform and bold initiative. So I think they will move the value of their currency up. I think it's going to be much more gradual than it should be and than we would like it to be. But that's where their politics take them.
Is there any danger, Tom, that you see of a trade war emerging from the House bill?
Well, if we were to impose countervailing duties against a Chinese product, assuming this bill is passed by the Senate and signed by the President, and then we go through the process that Mr. Bergson described, a long and complicated one, and we impose a countervailing duty on some Chinese product, the Chinese are certain to take us into the WTO on this because, I mean, it's just a logical move for them. They could also respond in the same way they responded when we imposed dumping margins on Chinese tires some time back, and they responded by imposing dumping margins on U.S. exports to China of frozen chicken parts, and they recently increased that duty to over 100% of ad valorem, alleging that we subsidize our chicken production in the United States, which may or may not be true. But that's the kind of thing you really don't want to get into. I must say I agree very much with Mr. Lieberthal about the Chinese attitude on this, the Chinese view of the United States. And to the extent we can use multilateral institutions, I agree with what Mr. Bergston said, that it's been a disappointing process, and the IMF has been involved with this issue now for many years, 5 years at least. If we can use these institutions and get other countries to step forward, get India, get Vietnam, get Brazil and others to step forward on this, we have a much better chance, ultimately, of achieving the objective. We also need to make clear to the Chinese, if we can, I think we can make the case, whether they believe it or not, I don't know, is that their deliberate undervaluation of their currency is basically not in the long-term interest of China, because it has a terribly distorting impact on the Chinese economy as the Bank of China involves itself in this massive currency operation that Mr. Bergston described. And it also has the very perverse effect of making relatively poor Chinese workers subsidize the consumption of relatively rich people in the developed world. I mean, it's a nutty situation.
Yeah.
And if I were a Chinese citizen looking at this, I might say, what is our government up to?
Fred Bergston, what about the administration itself? You've accused the White House of failing to act on this issue.
I think they have failed to deliver effective results. They certainly have tried, but I don't think, for example, they've made the big effort to put together a multilateral coalition of the type we're all talking about here. They haven't gotten on a plane, gone to these capitals, and tried to line up a coalition. There's going to be a big test in 10 days. The Secretary of the Treasury has to file a report with the Congress twice a year on this currency issue, under current law, and indicate whether any foreign countries are manipulating their currencies. That report is due October 15th. The Secretary of the Treasury has said he will submit the report. if there's no further progress on the currency over the next 10 days, if the Chinese don't let it move a lot, I think it would be very hard for him not to indicate that China is manipulating. At the hearings 3 weeks ago, 15 senators from both parties universally excoriated the secretary. I was there, witnessed it. I testified right after him and said, everybody in the world knows they're manipulating, but you won't acknowledge it. You won't admit it. Why not? Senator Schumer said three times, what are you afraid of? So the gauntlet's been put down. A lot of this does go to domestic politics here, relations between the Congress and the administration. But note, in the Congress, this one is totally bipartisan. The House vote attracted over 300 supporting yeas. 100 Republicans voted for it. So on this one, the domestic politics is pretty uniform.
Ken Labenthal.
I just want to note that, as Fred said a while ago, the Chinese have been controlling the value of their currency for years. And for years, American Treasury Secretaries, Republican and Democratic, have not been identifying them as a currency manipulator. And for years, members of Congress have been excoriating Secretaries of the Treasury for not doing so. The reality is, if you identify China as a currency manipulator, the consequences of that are zero, which is to say all that the legislation requires then is that you engage in intensive discussions with the Chinese about their manipulation of their currency. But we've been doing that for years. Secretary Paulson did it. Secretary Geithner has done it. The president has done it directly. The Chinese, though, will react very strongly. They'll react very strongly because they'll consider it to be a major loss of face. They have been identified as, in some fashion, a rogue player. Mm-hmm. When we never identified the Japanese, when the Japanese manipulated their currency and so forth. So they will take retaliatory action, I believe, simply as a matter of face. So the question is, I understand the politics of this, but in the real world, I don't think it's going to produce any results that we're very pleased with.
Tom, you've said the problem is really not the Chinese. You've said we are the principal problem. What do you mean?
You mean the United States?
Yes.
Well, our trade deficit, which is one of the issues that underlies this bigger or separate issue of the Chinese currency, is largely a function of the performance of our own economy and the fact that our savings rate is at some point less than zero. It's now gone back up as a result of the economic crisis, but the balance of trade is very much related to the way in which our economy functions, the relationship between consumption, saving, investment. And because we save so little, we tend to have this very large merchandise trade deficit. And the Chinese know this, and they point it out to us from time to time, that we need to rebalance our own economy, and there's no question that we definitely need to do that. Getting to the point that Mr. Liebertal just made about the declaration or statement that Secretary Geithner has to make on the 15th of October, I certainly agree with him. Unfortunately, if Secretary Geithner fails to mention China, and given all of the publicity and all the concern that's been expressed, it really won't pass the laugh test in Washington. And, that's an issue that the administration has to consider.
Right. Let me address Ken Lieberthal's critical point. How would the Chinese react to being labeled a manipulator, or for that matter, passage of this bill? It is absolutely correct, as Ken says, that the Chinese vehemently argue that they will never act under foreign pressure, that it would be, in fact, counterproductive for the U.S. to put the spotlight on them. That would reduce the prospect that they would take corrective action with the exchange rate. And that, I think, is why all the secretaries of Treasury, as Ken rightly said, have been reluctant and unwilling to label them. I guess I doubt the basic premise. I happen to have been in this business now for over 40 years, and I've had experience with a whole string of surplus countries with undervalued currencies. And the truth is that whether it was Germany, Japan, Korea, or anybody else, they were totally unwilling to act without foreign pressure. Mm. They were never willing to move on their own. They could never get off the comfortable position of subsidizing their trade and big trade surpluses. It took outside pressure. That could be market pressure, but the Chinese blocked that with comprehensive capital controls. So the only thing left is political pressure. I know what Ken Wrightly reports they say. He may be right in forecasting the outcome, but I do observe that when the congressional pressure built 4 or 5 years ago, that's when the Chinese did let their exchange rate go up 20% over a couple of years. When the congressional hearings loomed 3 weeks ago, the Chinese suddenly let the exchange rate go up at least a couple of percent. So they say one thing. I'm not sure they're going to behave that way. Ken knows their psychology better than I do, but I think it's an open question.
Ken.
Well, again, I think that they react to pressure. They do not react the way you want them to when you cause them to lose face. And I think that branding them a currency manipulator will not get the reaction that we would like to have. We'll have to see, but that would be my expectation. Let me make a broader point, if I can, also, which is that much of the argument behind this is that China's control of the value of its currency has a very significant effect on the U.S.-China bilateral trade balance. That's where a lot of the animus on the Hill comes from. I think that premise is not correct. I think China's control of the value of its currency has a lot of bad effects on global trade, but only a marginal effect on the U.S.-China trade balance.
Kenneth Lieberthal, he's senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Rockville, Maryland. Good morning, David. David, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go right ahead, sir.
Okay, I live in Rockville. I came from China 15 years ago, and I'm doing well in this country, and this is a great country. I really like it. I love it, okay? And also, I love this program very much because I often listen to this program not only for learning knowledge, but also improve my English. Now, I really comment on the global economy and the currency issue. I feel that, based on my experience in both countries, the people and leaders, the politicians in this country, are either too nice or too naive, okay? I often hear a politician, including President Bush and President Obama, said that American people, workers, can compete and win in any field on equal platform or equal footing. But actually, that's not true. I know that in China, compared to Chinese people, Americans will never win in many fields, such as the manufacturing industry, you know, making socks, you know, fishing gear, toys, many, many other things. Americans will never win in terms of labor rate, working conditions, worker protection, things like that. I feel that all the problems come from the so-called global economy. Money, in my view, money is just like water. It flows from high to low. What global economy makes is produced is that making this country rich people become future people.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. Fred Bergsten.
Well, I basically want to go back to something Ken said in the last exchange when he suggested that a change in the currency would only have a marginal effect on the trade flows, which is a question also the caller raised. I think that's just wrong. We and others have done in-depth analysis of the issue. You can't be overly precise, but our judgment is that if the Chinese let the currency go up 20%, it would take their global trade surplus down by $300 billion or more, and it would take the U.S. global trade deficit down between $50 and $100 billion. That would create 500,000 good, high-paying jobs in the United States, mainly in manufacturing. To the caller, I would say, price makes a huge difference, and the U.S. can certainly compete better if its price disadvantage of 20 to 40% against China is eliminated through the currency moves we're talking about.
Ken.
Fred just referred to China's global deficit and our global deficit, or global surplus and then our global deficit, and I refer to the bilateral trade balance. If you look at what China exports to the United States, two-thirds of the value of those exports consists of things China imports from other countries, mostly in Asia, assembles in China and then exports to the United States. So if China increases its exchange rate by 20% vis-a-vis the U.S., two-thirds of that is already offset because their imported parts and components have become 20% cheaper to them to buy. So we're really down to about a 7% swing. Then if you look at the price from China of an item as compared with the retail price in the United States, the price out of China is only about 15% of the retail price in the U.S. on balance. So you're talking about a relatively small change in a relatively small part of the price in the U.S. I just don't think it's going to make a very big difference.
But Diane, then the question to Ken is, so why do the Chinese fight it so fiercely if it's not going to make any difference?
And the answer is that they have politics, too. And they have a big export industry that's politically very powerful and doesn't want to see this change.
Ken Lieberthal of the Brookings Institution. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by Saab, for people who have a different perspective on driving. Learn more at SaabUSA.com. Saab, move your mind. This is NPR.
The Environmental Outlook Series, the case for urban agriculture and why vertical farms could be a solution. Commercial farming as we know it will be unable to meet the demands of the additional 3 billion people projected to be on Earth by 2050. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour.
Welcome back. We'll go right to the phones to Little Rock, Arkansas. Good morning, Angelo.
Good morning, Diane. I hope you're feeling better soon.
I will be. I promise.
Great. The focus on the whole discussion has been on the United States and Chinese relations and the fact that China is devaluing its currency, which is bad, maybe bad for China, is bad for the United States business. But what about the consumer? The United States, these Chinese are subsidizing a cost of their items for the American consumer. If the American consumer, if this crazy bill goes through, the American consumer will get it in the neck because his prices will go up. First, because the Chinese goods will go up. And it's a small percentage of the total cost, of course, but yeah, as the production cost goes up, the cost gets transferred down the line. Everybody goes up. The second thing is that if China won't buy these garbage American dollars, who will? So that means the United States gets devalued. All foreign goods will go up. The consumer gets it in the neck again. Now, it's nice to talk about American business, but the truth is, if those jobs that get formed, they'll be shipped out to Mexico and Guatemala, like one of your one of the contestants said before, the United States won't get the jobs. These other companies will.
All right. Tom Niles.
Yes, ma'am.
Is.
Well, I would like to say that I tend to agree with Ken Liebertal that if the Chinese were to allow their currency to appreciate, say, by 20% versus the dollar and other world currencies, that the actual impact on U.S. imports would probably be fairly small. One thing we haven't talked about, though, is in a positive sense, if that were to happen, U.S. exports to China would probably increase. I wouldn't say by an enormous amount, but we would U.S. exports that are not now competitive on the Chinese market because of the subsidization of the currency would be more competitive. So we would get some more business in China, and that would be beneficial to the United States. I agree with the caller from Arkansas who said that there would be some impact on consumer prices in the United States were the Chinese currency to appreciate. I'm not sure how great that would be, but certainly one of the factors that has held down inflation on a worldwide basis, not just in the United States over, say, the last 10 years, has been the availability of highly competitive, low-cost goods from China and other countries which have to compete with China. So to the extent that the Chinese goods become more expensive, there could be some impact. I wouldn't think it would be huge, but an impact on inflation rates in the United States.
Fred.
Three quick points. Tom is right that at least our studies show that the biggest gains to the U.S. from China letting its currency go up would be on the export side. It would improve our competitiveness 20 to 40% across the entire range of export products. Those produce very high-paying, good jobs in the United States. That's where the great bulk of the improvement would occur, and that would be a big objective of the exercise. Secondly, the caller is exactly right. And Ked said it before, the Chinese currency undervaluation subsidizes the American and other foreign consumers. They keep their prices cheap, and that passes through Walmart stores to the American purchaser. But like in all of economics, there's no free lunch. Our consumers get the goods more cheaply, but that also means the Chinese get the sales instead of American producers and American workers. So at some point, you have to say, what's the fair balance? And when we calculate an equilibrium exchange rate, which the Chinese are manipulating and staying away from, it's an effort to balance the gains for economic growth and employment in the economy versus the impact on the consumer. But he's quite right. The consumer will lose because some of those cheaper goods won't be around. Final point, he talked about what happens if the Chinese no longer buy garbage dollars. Well, first of all, under any scenario, the Chinese are going to continue to run very large trade surpluses. They already hold $2.5 trillion. They have a huge interest in avoiding trashing the value of the dollar because they're the world's biggest holders of them. And even if they don't buy as many additional dollars in the future, which is the objective because we want to get their trade surplus down, other people in the global financial markets for dollars will do so. Again, might be a small impact, slightly higher interest rates, but right now interest rates are virtually zero, no inflation in sight. This is actually the best time to get these currency changes.
Can't.
Just on the issue of whether we would get jobs if Chinese exports to the United States were reduced, China generally exports to the United States low-end products, and they are very unlikely to be products that then come back to U.S. manufacturing. They would rather go, as someone mentioned earlier, to Vietnam, Indonesia, Bangladesh, et cetera, rather than back to U.S. manufacturing. We do better at the high end. So we should be focusing on exports. I think it's not a we're not going to see a strong jobs effect simply from a reduction of Chinese sourcing of our imports from Asia.
All right. To Winter Springs, Florida. Good morning, Danny.
Good morning. I have an uneducated question, but I wanted to preface it with a couple of sentences to make sure I'm hearing what I think I'm hearing.
Sure.
What I'm hearing is that China is creating an unfair trade advantage by buying up to $1 billion a day of U.S. currency, and my question, which again is uneducated, is why can't we play the same game and neutralize the economic impact of that by spending or marketing or trading up to $1 billion a day of their currency?
You wrote about this, Fred.
Danny, that is not an uneducated question at all. You must have read my op-ed in the Financial Times yesterday where I proposed exactly that. Somebody said at the start of the program, I think Ambassador Niles, that this countervailing duty bill was not a very effective way to go after the problem. And that is correct. I agree with that. There are many more effective things we could do. And you just identified one. I call it countervailing currency intervention as opposed to countervailing import duties. We could do exactly what Danny said. We could offset their purchases of dollars by selling dollars, neutralize the exchange rate effect, and I think probably deter the whole practice. There is a technical problem in the Chinese case. Their currency is inconvertible. You can't just go into the market and buy it like you can Japanese yen, euros. Nevertheless, we could find proxies. The message would be unmistakable. It would unleash a lot of private speculative money into the RMB, and I think that would be much more effective. There is a provision of that type in the Senate bill that Schumer and 17 other senators will consider when the Senate turns
now,
to this
issue. That differs from the House bill.
That's an additional, it's got the same as the House bill, but it's got this additional element that they call remedial intervention.
What do you think of that, Ken?
Well, I think that the U.S. generally argues against currency intervention by government. So if we were to pursue this, one of the downside repercussions would be that we're setting an example of the kind of behavior that we do not want others to follow. I think right now around the world, one of the really big global threats, and I think China is very much on the wrong side of this, but one of the really big global threats is competitive devaluation through government intervention. Hmm. And that is a race to the bottom. No one wins that race. And if we join that race, I don't think we're doing anyone a lot of good in the process.
But Ken, we're not setting the precedent. The Chinese have been doing it hugely for 5 years. We're trying to get them to cease and desist.
Tom, what do you think of that?
I think I agree entirely with Ken Lieberthal. To jump into this pit would be a huge mistake, I think, for the United States. And, you know, the other countries are beginning to follow China's bad example. I mentioned a few of them, Brazil, Japan, the Koreans, and if the United States suddenly were to adopt this same business, we'd be back in the 1930s when we had competitive devaluations, and at the end, everybody lost.
All right.
So I think that that's a very bad idea. Again, I get back to the point I made before. We don't want to make this a U.S.-China great power ego issue. We want to try to build pressure on the Chinese, but from the world, because it is a world issue. It's not just a U.S.-China issue.
All right. Next up is Pat in Lakewood, Ohio. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. I guess I was curious. So much that goes on in the world, as I see it, seems to be based on, you know, whoever the biggest player is on the field. And if I'm looking at this from the Chinese standpoint, they have gotten to be, you know, the 800-pound gorilla. And in some cases, you know, they can do what they want, just as we do in some foreign diplomatic items. What I keep hearing is some of these people seem to be talking about everything as though everything revolves around the United States. And I'm not sure they're, and I understand maybe that may be, you know, the player they're representing. However, to me, if I'm looking at what's in the best interest of the country involved, in this case China, I can see exactly why they do what they want. And, you know, when as somebody, you know, starts rattling the sabers and everything, saying, well, you know, this is not in their best interest, and this is not good for us. And I almost have to laugh sometimes and say,
you know, the Chinese do regard us as the 800-pound gorilla. Our per capita GDP is 13 times China's per capita GDP. But having said that, the gap between us and the Chinese has narrowed over the last several years. They've done better in managing through the financial and economic crises than we have. I think one of the problems in our relationship now is that there are many in China, especially at a popular level, who think that gap has narrowed very dramatically and that the momentum is on China's side. So it's now, therefore, time for China to do exactly what Pat just suggested, to do things their way and have the U.S. adjust, right? The reality is the gap is narrow, but not dramatically. And so when China tries to do things their way, we don't cooperate, and frictions rise very rapidly, and the Chinese find there's very little they can do about that. So we're in a period of transition. The reality is, for the Chinese economy, the U.S. is still by far the biggest player in the world. They need to take us very seriously, but we have to understand this is a huge, important, rising country with complicated politics of its own. And the reality is both of us have to do a good job of understanding the other and reaching some compromises here, or we're both going to be very big losers because we're highly interdependent.
Fred, how likely is it that this bill is going, already passed by the House, is going to be addressed by the Senate?
It's very hard to say. The relevant committees in the Senate have not prepared for legislative action in the lame duck session after the election. On the other hand, there is a lot of political pressure to move on this issue. And Senator Schumer, for example, has said on the floor, I guarantee this bill will come to the floor. It will pass by an overwhelming majority. It'll even be veto-proof. We just don't know, and it may depend on how the election comes out.
Fred Bergstein, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Now to Princeton, New Jersey. Good morning, Linda.
Good morning, Diane. What a nightmare we're talking about. I just want to know, is it safe for me to go off to Scotland and live in a little shack somewhere? That's my dream. My question involves the borrowing that the United States government has done to fund the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. How much money was borrowed from China over what period of time?
Do we know?
And how much borrowed from Japan?
Do we know?
Money is fungible, so we didn't borrow directly from China or Japan to fund the wars. But the fact that we've been running huge budget deficits, higher because of those wars, has clearly increased our reliance on foreign countries to finance the U.S. economy.
Why don't we know how much came from China, how much came from Japan?
Well, we know roughly what the level of their dollar holdings are. In the case of China, probably between $1.5 trillion, $2 trillion that they hold in total U.S. assets. The financial markets are fungible, so whether they buy treasuries or something else is not that critical. But they've been funding our consumption, our economic activity, to a very large extent. Something like half of all our government borrowing in recent years has come from foreigners, of which China's number one, Japan's number two. So we've been reliant on them. And again, as somebody said before, that's our fault. We've let ourselves get into huge dependency.
Ken.
Fred is right, but let me texture that a little bit. If you look at U.S. treasuries, China holds less than 10% of U.S. treasuries. Generally, it's held less than 7% of U.S. treasuries. The same is true of other major debt, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, what's called agency debt. So the reality is the Chinese have gotten themselves in a bad position. They have taken a very high percentage of their dollar holdings and put them into U.S. sovereign and agency debt, basically loaned them to the United States to use. But they hold a relatively small percentage of our total debt because our debt markets are so enormous and so liquid and so wide-ranging. So it's almost as if, this is inexact but maybe help clarify things, it's almost as if you as an individual took a large percentage of your wealth and bought the stock of General Electric. And after that, do you have enough stock in General Electric to tell General Electric what to do? No, you don't. But do you have a huge interest in General Electric's doing well? You certainly do. Mm. And China is roughly in that kind of position with the U.S. It isn't that China can tell us what to do. We obviously want the Chinese to keep buying. We have an interest in things going well. But if anyone has leverage here on balance, in the sense that is more consequential for us, for them, what we do, rather than whether they keep buying our treasuries at the same level. I think the leverage is more on our side on this one.
I think this discussion, which we've had many times on this program, is likely to continue. Thank you all so much. Fred Bergsten, Ken Lieberthal, former Ambassador Thomas Niles. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.